in, then closes up the bottom, and after she puts the weeds back in, she hooks the whole works up again onto a rafter. I count three baskets over from the corner and wonder if she'll remember which basket she put it in. It's hard to see in her room because she's got so many baskets of weeds hanging all over, but squeezed in there she has a chair and a small bed with a brown blanket, just like we all got. There's nothing on the wood floor and no window, but she got a table with some quill pens and some ink with some paper sitting to the side. Later, I found out that she uses the paper to write down who is sick and how many babies got born, and every week she gives that over to the two white men who come to see her. I wonder when she's going to send my letter off. I don't like this place, and I want to go home.
Chapter 28, 1830, Suki. Even though I say that I don't want nothing to do with this boy, I never seen nothing like him before. Almost every night now he rubs my hands down, and I don't remember something ever feeling so good. Trouble is, he got that sweet way about him, and while he's rubbing my hands, he keeps asking me questions. I don't give no answers 'cause there is none. One night he say, "What happens if I get took for a slave?" I keep my eyes closed like I don't hear him, and I try not to think about it. He's small in size, but he's about the same age as me the first time I got sold. And thinking back on it, I don't know how I come through. I forget how many days we was tied up and traveling, but on our last day, when they drive us through the town, I hang my head because people stop what they're doing when they see us coming. Some laugh and poke fun, but most only get quiet when they look at us. Some shake their head and look away. One of the slave men that's tied can't take no more and starts yelling at the town people watching us. "What you looking at? What you looking at?" The trader slaps a whip at him, but that don't stop him, and he starts to laugh in a way that scares me. It's like he can't stop himself. I's feeling so low that I don't look up no more. I just want to get to the auction yard, and when we do get there, I almost feel good. The place has a high wood fence around it, and they got to unlock a big door to let us in. We don't have no time to look around before they free us from the line. When they untie me from Ernest, I see his hands shaking, and that makes my stomach knot up. I never see him look scared like this before, and I was wondering what he knows that I don't know. They hand me over to an old woman, and I think maybe she's a slave herself because she's rough in her talk when she takes me out to a small woodshed. There she brings two buckets of cold water, a rag, and a chunk of soap. She has me take off my clothes and shoes and tells me to wash myself, all the while shaking her head as she watches. But I don't care. Let her look. When I start to wash, my sore skin burns like it's on fire. I don't stop, but I soap up and scrub the stink away. Real nice, I ask the woman to bring me two more buckets of water. When she does, I soap up again, then rinse myself over and over. The cold water bites at me, and I keep catching my breath with each dose, but at least I feel clean. The woman hands me a big rag to dry myself with, then gives me an old and mostly clean brown petticoat and dress. We don't talk, but she keeps watching everything I do. Now that I's clean, I start to feel more like my old self. "Please," I say, "I need to write a letter. Could you help me?" She sighs and shakes her head. "I just know that you were somebody's pet. It was those clothes and those shoes. And now you talking about writing. I see this over and over. Young ones like you starting to look too good to the master. The wife sell you off. That what happened?" She brings over a brown rag to tie around my head and talks low into my ear.
Don't you go telling nobody here that you can write.
She steps back with her hands on her hips to look me over.
You been with a man yet?
I shake my head, pretty sure of what she's saying.
You start your bleeding yet?
I nod, wishing she'd stop asking me these questions. She makes a face.
Till you're sold, you keep your eyes down, you keep your head down. Don't go smiling at no mens. They ask, you say you trained for the big house.
Then she hands me a gray blanket and takes me out to a stall. Inside the high wall that hides the slave pen, a dirt yard runs down the whole side of what looks like a long barn. The big building has rooms that look like stalls in the horse barn, with doors that have bars across the windows. In time, I find out that they need those windows so buyers can get a look at us before they put us on the block. Inside the stall I get put in, there's a dirt floor with clean hay spread out. There, a woman and a small child sit on a bench against the wall across from the door. The woman looks up at me when I come in, but doesn't say nothing. Her girl is asleep with her head in her mama's lap.
What happens to us now?
I ask when we are alone.
Now we get sold, she say real quiet.
Who will buy us?
Some men's come, they look us over. I gon' tell them I got to take my Jenny or I don't go. I just don't go no place without my Jenny. No, sir, I don't go no place without my Jenny. No, sir, I don't.
I don't like the way she keeps saying the same thing over and over, so I sit on the other bench. But when I sit on my sore parts, I get up again. I stand up until I can't no more. And then I wrap the gray blanket around me, and I lay down on the hay. The dirt floor underneath stinks like a privy, but I shut my eyes and right away I sleep. Early the next morning, I hear men talking outside the window. One of the voices is Jake's.
She's trained for the big house, he says. Worked there all her life, but she knows a place. She's good with little ones and knows how to cook good, too. Only lived in one place, been treated right all her life. But with the crops last year, Mr. Pike's needing to sell some off. She's one of his best, and he's looking for a good price.
You say she's good with children, another voice asked. All by herself, she took care of three little ones at the big house, Jake said.
Let's take a look, the unknown voice said.
The door squeals open. I sit up, feel the soreness on my bottom, and quick get to my feet. The other woman gets up from the ground and moves fast to sit on a bench and pulls her daughter onto her lap.
Suki, Jake comes strutting to me, full of himself.
This here man is looking to buy you before I even have a chance to put you up on the block.
Jake talks like him and me as friends. The man looks me over, turns me round two or three times, then asks me to show him my hands. My hands are clean, but my nails are all broke up. He turns them over to look at my palms.
It don't look like you do much heavy work, he say.
Like I said, she was only used for the big house, Jake say. Mr. Pike spoils his house, niggers. Should never live down in the quarters.
Can you sew? The new man asks.
I look up to see that he's older than his voice sounds. His clothes are cut good, but he isn't dressed like a man from a big house. Later I find out that he's a buyer for the farm he works on. His eyes are waiting on me. I nod.
I can sew, I say.
Jake pokes me on my shoulder.
Speak up!
Yes, I can sew real good, I say.
The man grunts.
Talk like you might have a little book learning in you, too.
No, she don't, Jake says. Mr. Pike don't allow no niggers on his place, no book learning.
You know how to read or write? The man asked.
Yes, I can read and write, I want to say. I can read good. But I know what I got to do. I drop my head and shake it.
I think they're gonna want this one, he say. I'll give you 700 for her.
Jake almost falls over his own feet as he goes for the door.
I'll get the papers on her, he say.
Hold on, the man calls. He points to the woman's child, Jenny.
Let me have a look at her. They want another girl, one they can teach from small on.
Jake goes over and pulls the child off the mother's lap to stand in front of the buyer. The girl is maybe 4 or 5 and looks up at the man with her small round face like she's trying to understand what's going on. The mama comes quick and pulls her girl against herself.
She don't get sold lest I go with her, she say.
We don't need nobody for the fields, the man says. I'm just here to buy 2 young ones for the big house. Your girl here will work out just fine for that.
I can work the big house real good, the woman says, doing her best to smile at the man. The man grunts.
You know you never worked the big house. I saw the papers on you. Only place you worked was the fields.
Please, mister. I work like 3 peoples. You put me up in the big house.
They ain't looking for nobody like you.
My Jenny don't go if I don't go, the mother says it like she means it.
Please, mister, she say, but she can't hold back her crying.
Listen, you can make this easy or hard on your young one. She's getting a chance to work in a big house with good people. They treat their people fair. You let her go, she got a chance to make a place for herself in a big house. Otherwise, she's going to end up a field worker just like you. And you know once you're on that block, they don't care about keeping you with her. Chances are you get sold apart anyway.
It looks like the mama's going to start bawling, but when her girl looks up at her, the woman works her mouth against itself.
She looks me over good, then quick, she puts her girl's hand in mine.
Jenny, you go with this nice woman's. She take good care of you. I come find you someday, and then you gonna be running a big house just like your mama always wanna do.
The man sees this is a good time to get going, so he picks up the child and slings her over to me.
Find the owner and get the papers, he says to Jake, and nods me toward the door.
As we go, the girl figures out what's happening and starts to call back for her mama. My heart turns over when I hear the mother doing her best to sound happy.
It gonna be all right, Jenny. You go along now. Your mama gonna come find you.
As we make our way out of the auction yard and into the man's wagon, the child puts her arms around me and holds on tight. It's like she knows that crying won't do her no good, but her little heart is pounding so fast and hard that I can feel it against my own. When we get to our new place, they think that Jenny is my sister, so I don't say nothing different. Fact is, that's the way I come to see her. She was a good girl, and when she asks when her mama's coming, I always say, any day now, Jenny girl. She coming any day now. If I was ever looking to find the child, all I got to do was go out to the front of the house where she'd be looking down the road watching for her mama. It got so that I'd have done anything for the girl. Looking back, I wonder if caring for her took out some of the sting of my own worries. At our new place, the people was good enough to their slaves. There was plenty of food, and Jenny and me slept in the kitchen house with the cook. The mistress had 4 young girls, and we helped her out with them. But we was there no more than 4 months when the 2 youngest got the fever and died. Not 2 days later, the mistress goes down with the same thing. Then Jenny. We try to save them, but even with the doctor coming,
There's nothing we can do to keep them going.
They both go. First the wife, then Jenny. One right after the other.
When Jenny goes, the cook tells me if I don't stop crying, I get sick myself. But that child was like my own. Some nights I still wake up wondering what I'm going to say if Jenny's mama ever shows up.
After the wife is gone, the master walks around like he can't remember his name, then sends his other two girls to live with his own mama up in Washington. I guess he don't have no more need of me, 'cause he sells me off by the end of that month. All told, I was there about 6 months.
The next place they sell me to is a preacher's farm.
Chapter 29. 1830. James. In the early morning I posted the letters, then anxiously boarded the stage. My destination was Edenton, North Carolina, located some 90 miles south of Norfolk. According to the map, Southwood, the plantation where Pan hopefully awaited me, was located some miles north of Edenton. How Henry had obtained the details of where his son was taken he had not said, though he did suggest a strong underground connection by which messages were passed. How reliable this information was, I did not know, yet it was all I had to go on. I planned to stay in the town to uncover information about the owner of the plantation and hope that freeing Pan would be as simple as offering a heavy purse. I dreaded the transaction, for I would be obliged to go to a plantation that owned slaves, the thought of which petrified me. As the coach moved along, I forced myself away from these thoughts and tried to put my focus on what was out the window. At any other time, the road we traveled would have had my full attention, for it ran alongside the canal that had been dug through the Great Dismal Swamp. This waterway was now the major thoroughfare connecting the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia to the Albemarle Sound in North Carolina. And it had been dug by slaves who inched their way through 22 miles of impassable jungle. Now large barges, sloops, and schooners all traveled the route, carrying trade and passengers to and from the Norfolk region down into North Carolina. This vast swamp was so huge that it was said to cover over 1 million acres. What had interested me since childhood were the numbers of unrecorded botanical and bird species said to be found in the region. So it was that as we rode along, in spite of all my anxiety and emotional turmoil, I began to take note of my surroundings. Seated at a window on the right of the carriage, I was able to look out onto the canal and was struck again and again by the multitudes of turtles basking on logs that bobbed on the water's edge. It was already mid-May, and I might have opened my window for some fresh air had I not been so concerned with giving entry to the swarms of biting flies and mosquitoes. I peered across the waterway and into the swamp, but it was impossible to see through the tangled reeds and bushes and into the dense and dark stands of juniper and cypress that reportedly sheltered bear and bobcat and the cottonmouth snake. 4 other passengers were in the coach with me, along with their excess luggage. A middle-aged father and his 2 daughters, accompanied by a female servant, were returning home from a visit to Williamsburg. Shortly after our journey began, introductions were made. But I soon turned again toward the window and paid little attention to them until, sometime into the ride, I became aware of the older of the 2 girls making whispered comments to her younger sister.
"Oh, Addie, you don't think..."
"I do."
The younger one, dressed in pink and blue flowered calico, looked to the father whose attention was focused at the window.
"Oh, Papa, are we truly in danger?" she asked.
"What?" he asked, shaking himself as though out of a reverie.
"Addie said that we are in danger. Is that true?"
"Certainly not," he said. "Addie, you must stop frightening your sister." He frowned at his eldest daughter.
"Father, you know as well as I that there are escaped slaves who hide out in these parts, and that should they ever stop our coach, we would be murdered for our clothing alone."
She rose slightly from her seat to adjust her full skirts, also of calico, but hers of a green color and a larger pattern. "Addie, I asked you to stop this talk," the father said. I glanced over at the Negro servant and guessed she was not yet as old as Miss Addie. Though she did not speak, the young servant's eyes told me that she, too, was frightened.
"Father," Addie said, I would rather we were all prepared to meet our death than to sit in ignorance should the worst present itself.
The three girls sat opposite the father and myself. Now the youngest of the sisters lurched over to sit between us. As bags between us were set to the floor, the young girl removed her bonnet and handed it to her father before she settled herself against his shoulder.
"Oh, Papa,"
she said, slipping her arm into his.
"You would not let them kill us?"
"Of course not, Patty. I am well armed," he said, making a show of thumping the traveling bag that sat wedged between his feet. He settled her bonnet on top of the bag. Any renegades would learn in short order who they were dealing with.
"So I see, Father, that you acknowledge there is danger,"
Addie said.
"Is there, Papa?"
the young one asked.
"Are there bad slaves hidden out here?"
He sighed unhappily as he gave a dour look to his oldest daughter. "It is rumored so." Patty leaned across his lap to stare out the window.
"But why here, Papa?" she asked. "Why would anyone come here? Just look. See how dark it is in the trees? And look at the water. It is so brown that it looks like coffee. Why is that, Papa? Why is the water brown?"
"I've heard it said that it is because of all the dead Negroes," Addie said. "The snakes got them."
"Adelaide," the father said, "stop teasing your sister. You know full well that the water is the color it is because of the tannin from the cedars. One more word from you, miss, and that new gown coming from Williamsburg shall be returned." Addie gave a light laugh.
"Daddy, you know that you would as soon see me naked as without my new dress."
Patricia gasped, and the servant girl gaped open-mouthed while her father shook his head at his daughter.
"What would your poor dear mother say?"
His voice broke, and Addie, who recognized that a line had been crossed, spoke up.
"I apologize to you, Father, as well as to everyone present."
She nodded toward me.
"I do believe that the danger we face has me overexcited. I do not like the feeling that this land gives off, and the sooner we are through it, the happier I shall be."
She sat back, satisfied for the moment. She sighed and then removed her bonnet as her younger sister had done. A pale green ribbon held her black hair in place, but when she tossed her head, the ribbon slipped free. She shook her head again and did nothing to restrain her long hair when it fell loose around her shoulders, but her dark eyes glanced over to see her father's reaction to this demonstration of impropriety. When he did not appear to notice, she left it as it was. Then she looked at me and gave a bold smile. Catching her smile, the father, as though to apologize for his daughter's forthright behavior, addressed me. "Do you have children?" he asked. "I do," I said spontaneously, surprising myself with this easy acknowledgement. "A girl, I have a daughter."
"What is her name?"
Addie asked. "Caroline," I responded, but upon using the name I felt strange. There was only one Caroline, and she was dead. I must find another name for the baby. "So you have an understanding of young women?" the father asked. "Mine is but a babe," I said, forcing myself to recover quickly. "But," I smiled and nodded at Addie, "I see what is to come."
"Sir," Addie straightened herself, "I am not a child. I shall be 16 before the end of this year, and I am generally quite mature for my age."
The indulgent father smiled. "That might be an exaggeration, my dear."
"Oh, Papa," she said, sighing. "I dislike it so when you tease." "He wasn't teasing, Addie."
Patty reached her brown, square-toed shoe across and poked at her sister's leg, causing Addie to yelp. "Girls," the father corrected, while I, having enough with their foolishness, turned away to catch a glimpse of the land we passed through. Addie was right to say that the place was dark and foreboding, for it was that. And as I suppose she was right to say that many slaves had died here, from snake bites alone, since copperheads and cottonmouths were said to await their prey in the moss-covered trees. Her final assertion that slaves were hidden out within the treacherous confines of this dangerous swamp, I guessed might also be true. But I wondered what level of desperation it would take for a man to live in a place as forbidding as this.
"Sir," Addie said, pulling me back, "may I ask you a question?"
Her father inhaled sharply. "Certainly," I said.
"Was it a duel?" she asked.
"Pardon me," I said. "Was what a duel?" She raised her hand to touch her eye.
"This,"
she said, making reference to my eye patch. "Adelaide Matilda Spencer," her father said. I see now how right your mother was in wanting to send you off to a school. Where are your manners?
That is a personal question, the younger sister corrected.
One I am happy to answer, Mr. Spencer, I said, giving him a slight wink before turning toward Addie. Yes, it was a duel. Although I was injured, I'm afraid that he was the one who did not survive.
And was the duel because of a woman? She asked.
The coach was silent but for the bumping and jolting of the road. I glanced at the father before I answered Addie. It was, I said, knowing it was time to end the charade, yet I was reluctant to let go of this distraction that kept me from my own gloomy thoughts.
And she waits for you now?
No, I'm afraid that she died too. Miss Addie stared at me, and when I felt the father's frown, I addressed his daughter. I must apologize, for I'm afraid that I've been having fun with you. The truth is, since birth, I've been unable to see from my left eye, thus my eye patch, and though a duel did not take place, here I addressed the father, I did recently lose my child's mother.
Oh, you poor man,
Addie said with genuine feeling. The conversation was skirting too close to the truth, and hoping to put an end to it, I turned to look out the window. The father, sensing my discomfort, changed the subject. You were traveling down for business? He asked. I'm here to paint birds, I said, lying with the same ease that I had done for so much of my life.
An artist! Miss Addie exclaimed. How exciting!
I gave her a slight smile before turning back to her father. I'm here to study the birds and their habitats in this region. Are you funded, then? The father asked, rather to my surprise. I am, I lied again, by the Peale Museum in Philadelphia. I crossed my arms and sat back, hoping this uncomfortable line of questioning would end soon. Very good, he nodded his approval. There are many in our area who have ties up there. I'm sure they will be happy to welcome you. My heart thumped at the idea of word traveling down from Philadelphia, but I reassured myself that I would soon find Pan. Meanwhile, I would avoid most people and hope that word of any scandal involving me would not reach these rural parts.
And where will you stay? Addie asked.
That has not yet been decided, I said. I was hoping to find an establishment outside of Edenton where I might observe the birds in the wild. Perhaps I could find lodging on a farm or a working plantation.
Well, father, she said, why don't we have Mr. Burton stay with us?
Caught unaware, I looked nervously at her father and then at her. That is kind, Miss Adelaide, but I am looking to board somewhere within the vicinity of a place called Southwood. It is located... She gave me an open-eyed stare.
The land is next to ours, she said.
Startled, I mumbled something to her about the coincidence. The father turned to me. It is true we are neighbors of Southwood, his eyebrows lowered. But why Southwood? While traveling with Henry, I had already planned this lie, and now it came easily. Apparently, it is a region that has an unusually large collection of birds I wish to study. Well, we do have plenty of birds in the area, he said, though I've never given them much thought. Then came a sudden idea. With a personal introduction, this ordeal might be over with sooner than I had anticipated. Are you familiar with the owners of Southwood? Are they friends of yours? I asked hopefully. We have been neighboring farms for many years, but I'm afraid the owner is not in residence. So it is not a working farm? I asked, wondering why then slaves were needed. Oh no, it is a working farm. Cotton, wheat, flax, they grow it all on a large scale. The owner and his wife live in Raleigh, but it is managed and overseen by Bill Thomas. Is it a place where I might seek lodging? I'm afraid it is not set up for visitors, he said. I see, I said, disappointed.
Father, I insist that we invite Mr. Burton to stay with us, Addie said. Perhaps he can be persuaded to give us some art lessons.
She turned to me with a question and looked back to her father.
You know how Mother always wanted that for us?
From the look on the father's face, I saw the trump card that Addie played by invoking her mother's name. Adelaide, I was about to extend an invitation had you not spoken for me. Mr. Spencer shifted his position in my direction. Mr. Burton, what do you say? We are within walking distance of Southwood, though I am certain we have the same birds on our land that they have on theirs. If you decide otherwise, I will take you over myself and introduce you to Mr. Thomas, though I warn you he is not the type to have you tramping through his property. I could not have wished for a more favorable resolution. If all went well, my imposition would be short-lived. Well, I said, speaking aloud as I thought it through, I don't know. I wasn't expecting this kind offer. I don't want to take advantage, but it would certainly serve me well, particularly if you would be kind enough to give me an introduction to... Mr. Thomas, did you say? Mr. Spencer gave a quick nod.
Do come. It would make the house cheerful, since Mother...
Addie trailed off. I looked at the father. I said, I will do so if you would allow me, in exchange for a bed, to offer some watercolor classes to your daughters while I'm in your home.
How wonderful, Miss Addie sank back against her seat.
And you, Miss Patricia, I asked, are you in favor of learning to paint? She looked at me shyly with her deep-set brown eyes.
I am, she said. Although, of course, you cannot expect me to do as well as Addie. I am only 9, and she is... I'll soon be 16, Addie interjected.
Art is not a competition, I said to Patricia. If you have a natural inclination for it, art is a gift that you may choose to develop or not, regardless of age. Well put, said their father. It was our good luck to share this last leg of our journey with you, Mr. Burton, and we welcome you to our home. Be assured that your presence will provide a much-needed distraction. It will be difficult not to have Mrs. Spencer at home to greet us. He turned his head to gaze out the window. Patricia clutched her father's arm and dropped her head against it, as Addie turned to stare out the opposite window. While the coach rolled on and the girls napped, Mr. Spencer told me of his wife's recent death and childbirth. Taking the girls to visit relatives in Williamsburg was his attempt to help them all with their grief. Needing some time alone to adjust to his sorrow, he had intended to leave the girls in Williamsburg for the summer months, but when it came time for his departure, they had carried on so that he had felt he had no choice but to bring them back home, in spite of the summer's heat. Patricia most feels the loss, he said. Adelaide, although she was with her mother when she... Well, she seldom mentions her. I suppose she is older and more capable of understanding the realities of life. He went on to say again how grateful he was to have me return with them to their empty home, where my presence would serve as a buffer for the girls and a distraction for him as well.
Chapter 30 1830 Pan. When I finally get my feet under me and feel good enough to start walking around, I ask Suki to put me to work. I remember working hard for Mr. Burton and how he keeps me on. I think maybe I can do the same with Suki and work for her until Mr. Burton gets here. Sometimes if my legs get shaky, she makes me lay down, but I don't like to lay back because then I start to worry. It scares me thinking about how mad my daddy'll be that I went down to the docks and got took, just like he said. But I don't care. He can whoop me if he wants to. I just want to see him again. I worry, too, why Mr. Burton don't come. What's going to happen if he don't find me? I want to get home. I don't mind helping Suki out with the women who have babies, but one day they bring in a man they call a runner. Right away, Suki washes down his back, but when I'm wringing out the rags and handing them back, I can't hardly look, because he's so tore up. I'm holding a jar of her weed medicine that she's going to put on his back when in walks 2 white men. The room goes quiet. The runner stops his moaning, and even the 2 women having their babies don't call out no more. It feels the same way like after the thunder when you wait for the hit of lightning. The quiet scares me, and my legs feel shaky, so I sit down on one of the beds. The men come over to see what Suki's doing, then they start telling the runner what's going to happen next time he tries to leave the place. The 2 men are laughing when the one with the missing teeth sees me and walks over. He makes me stand up, and then he starts poking on my head. It hurts, and I want to tell him to cut it out, but the way Suki's got a lip squeezed together, I know to keep quiet. Is he getting steady on his feet? He asks Suki. She shakes her head. He pushes me, and I fall back on the bed. Talk about a waste of money, he says. A runt, and now he's sick to boot. We'll never get no decent kind of work out of him. Better off he'd have died with the other one. Less trouble all around. I get scared and stand up. I'm a good worker for my size, I say. He takes a good look at me. Oh, you don't say. Yes, sir, I say. I know how to lay fires and how to polish silver and... Well, he says, smiling at the other man while he's talking to me. Sounds to me like you work like a girl. No, I'm no girl. That's what I did for Mr. Suki gives out a loud grunt at the same time the runner lets out a yell that makes all of us jump. The two men tell the runner to shut up, but he keeps calling out for Jesus Lord to help him with his pain. Suki's standing beside his bed and waves at me to bring the medicine for his back. I take over the jar while the two men start walking away. The one missing his teeth looks back at me. I'll talk to Thomas about selling him off. Trade is coming through. At least we'll get a little something for him that way. Soon as they go, the runner stops calling out, but Suki gives me a look that says I done wrong. What did I do? I ask her. She pokes the runner's hand and he speaks for her. You got to learn to shut up, boy, he says, sounding mad as Suki looks. My head is hurting and I go to my bed to lay down. I didn't do nothing wrong. I was just talking up for myself. And now what? They were talking about selling me off? What if they do it before Mr. Burton gets here? Then how will he find me? When nobody's looking, I start to cry. That night, when the cook brings in the food, the grits look like they always do. I set down the wood bowl because I don't feel like eating. I lay back on my bed wondering how I can get myself out of here before they sell me for a slave. I'm crying when Suki comes over with the can of grease. After she sits, she surprises me and grabs hold of my hand and starts rubbing it down. At least she isn't mad at me no more, but I still can't stop crying. I want to go home. I want to see my daddy. And where is Mr. Burton? Don't he know I'm waiting on him? She keeps rubbing away until I settle down some, and then I figure out that she's scratching out words in my hand. I'm a good speller, but it takes a while for me to figure out what she's saying. Why don't she just talk like everybody else? You got to be strong like my boys, she writes. Soon as I figure out what she's writing, I sit up. She got boys. I wonder where they is. When she sees I'm going to talk, quick she holds her finger to her mouth. You got boys? I whisper. She nods and squeezes her eyes tight before she looks at me again. I look around, and even though everybody's sleeping, I whisper, Are they here? She shakes her head. Are they slaves? I ask. She nods again, but then she looks away, and her chin starts wobbling like she's gonna cry. Before I can say something, she gets up and goes to her room and shuts the door, and then I think I hear her crying. All night I wonder where her boys is at, and what's gonna happen to me.
Chapter 31, 1830, Suki. Pan keeps asking if he's gonna be a slave. What he don't know is that he already is one. Now they're saying that he'll get sold. How's he gonna make it through that? I wonder. He asks me about my boys, but I don't talk about them. It's hard enough to think back to the good times when I met their daddy at the preacher's farm. After Jenny dies and they sell me away, the preacher's nephew buys me and tells me he's bringing me to an old couple because they need the help. They have a small place and don't have no slaves but me, so I do all the cooking and cleaning and working in the garden. The first while I don't say much, but I watch how they are with each other. All that old man does is try to make his woman happy, running around trying to please, but nothing he can do is good enough. One day I ask her why she don't show him some kindness. You think that he was showing me kindness when he got that last girl, who you happen to be replacing, with a child, she asks. I don't know what to say to her, so I just stand there looking at her. That's right, that old fool, she says.
We were never able to have children of our own, but he lays down with a servant one time, and when it gets up, she's with a child.
Again, I stare. The longer I'm quiet, the more she keeps talking.
He said he was with the girl only one time, she snorted with disgust. One time? Who would believe that?
My face gets hot.
Don't you worry,
she says, like she knows what I'm thinking.
I've told him that if he lays down with another woman, he'd best enjoy it, because the next time he'll burn up in his bed.
Her eyes blaze with the thought, and I decide then not to tell her that her husband has already taken a liking to my bottom. He pinches at it whenever he thinks he has me alone, and I learn to move fast when I see him coming. In time, though, I learn to beat the old man at his game. As long as I let him have a pinch now and then, at night he lets me sit by the fire when he reads the Bible to his old woman. She always falls asleep, but he keeps reading until his eyes get tired. One night, just when the reading was good, he starts falling asleep himself.
You want me to read?
I ask, taking a chance.
Sure thing,
he says, and hands me the book like he don't know any better. I start to read then, and every night after, he hands me what he calls the good book. I read till they both drop off, and then I just keep going as long as I want. I don't know how, but 7 years pass this way. Each year the two of them moving slower, him trying to please her while pinching at me, and her happy with nothing he does. One morning, the nephew shows up and sees how slow the old man is getting, and that the farm work isn't getting done. He tells his uncle that he's going to buy him a Negro man to help with the farm work. The two old ones go along with whatever the nephew wants. So the next day, the nephew brings over the man he calls Nate. When I go to the well to pull up water, that Nate man is already at work fixing a plow. The old man and his nephew are in the house, and when Nate sees me pulling on the rope, heaving the water up, he comes over to help lift out the bucket. I see his arm muscles working that rope, and from then on, all I know is I want that man for my own. I could say it was his laugh that got to me, sweet and deep, but that isn't the truth. After I saw his working arms, what got to me was his eyes. He looked into mine, and there was no way out. After I tell the preacher's wife that I'm carrying Nate's baby, she tells her husband that it's only right that we marry. So there we are, September 1815, when I'm already 23, standing in front of that old preacher who reads from his Bible before telling us we're married. I wear a blue calico dress that I sewed up from some new fabric that the old woman gave me. I made sure to cut it big so I could wear it right up until the baby comes. At least, that's what I planned. But as time goes on, my stomach pushes out so far that Nate laughs every time I try to make that dress fit. When two babies show up, I get worried that the old man and woman will think there's too many to feed. But sometimes, we don't know nothing. When the old woman holds the first one, then the other, you'd have thought they was hers. She looks up at me and says they was the prettiest baby she's ever seen, and I have to say that she's right. We had two boys, and they both look just like Nate. I won't say too much more about that time, except that we had 5 years where I forgot everything except how to be happy. The old woman and even the old man cared about our babies almost as much as Nate and me. They each had a favorite, and my boys knew which one to go to when they wanted something extra. Nate and me ran the place, and we was good to those two old ones. The old man still pinched me if he could, but I never told my Nate, 'cause I was afraid he might do some pinching of his own. The nephew came every few months, but as long as things were moving along, he didn't have no complaints. Fact is, Nate had the place running better than I ever seen it, and the nephew saw it too. When the day came that the old woman dies, we were all standing round her bed, one crying louder than the next. Not 1 month later, the old man goes down too. All along, he was telling us that he was gonna give us our freedom. But when the nephew came, he said he didn't know nothing about that and sold Nate and me to two different farms. My Nate, a proud man, started crying and asked the nephew not to do it. But the nephew didn't care that we was a family. It takes two men to tie up my Nate and get him onto the wagon. That's all I'm saying about that.
Chapter 32. 1830. James. It was late afternoon when our coach deposited us at the Hornblower Tavern in Edenton. There we spent the night, and in the morning the Spencer's driver awaited us with their personal carriage. The girls were excited to be going home, and as we made our way to their farm, they eagerly pointed out landmarks. The land, though heavily treed, was as level as any I had ever seen.
"Look, look, there's the house!"
Both girls looked eagerly out the window as their home came into view. We had traveled an hour or so, and as we neared the farm, the young Negro maid joined the girls in their merry chatter. Clara had not been formally introduced to me, but through the girls I learned her name, her age of 13, and that she had early ties to the Southwood plantation.
When Father bought Clara's mother for our housekeeper, he bought Clara as well, but of course he had to pay a substantial sum for her.
Addie was interrupted by her father. "That is my business you are discussing," Mr. Spencer said.
"Yes, Father, but this is about our Clara, and I am only telling of your generosity in watching out for her,"
Addie explained.
"I don't see how that..."
Surprisingly, she stopped herself after exchanging a look with her father. So they did sell slaves from Southwood. How helpful to learn. And surely this must mean that Mr. Spencer had a good relationship, or at least a working relationship, with those at Southwood. Yet I saw how upset he was with Adelaide for bringing up what appeared to be a sensitive subject, so I decided to rest any questions I might have put to him. I had expected the Spencer house to look more like Tall Oaks, but though this white clapboard house appeared well built, it was much smaller in size. The terrain surrounding the home was flat, and the soil, I was told, was rich and fertile. Mr. Spencer was a farmer, but he operated on a small scale and owned, counting Clara, four servants. Although he appeared to be a kind and fair man, that he spoke of owning Clara in her presence did not escape me. Nor, I believe, from the lowering of her head did the meaning of it elude her. What a relief it was to finally arrive and leave the carriage, with one of us more travel-fatigued than the other. At the door, a middle-aged Negro woman welcomed all three girls with open arms amid exclamations of how they had grown in their 2 months away. Clara and Patricia wept in her embrace, while Addie encouraged me to follow her indoors, where I was soon shown around the house. While the other bedrooms were up a flight of stairs, I was led down a stairway to the simple but well-furnished bedroom offered me. What struck me, what pleased me, was that the room had its own entrance to the outdoors. Here I could come and go without question, and because I was uncertain what lay ahead, I welcomed the freedom. After I was left to myself, tired out from traveling, I was tempted to lie down on my bed, but instead I opened my trunk. First, I removed the soiled clothing from my travels and set it aside, hoping that the woman who had met us at the door would see to it. Next, I set my leather traveling case atop the dresser. Finally, I brought out my jackets, pants, and shirts and made use of the pegs on the wall. On removing my last pair of boots from the trunk, I found the heavy packet of coins that Robert had tucked into a bottom corner. Next to it was a package, one he hadn't mentioned. I opened it curiously, wondering what Robert had included that warranted a double wrapping. Of course, it was my old jacket, the one with my grandmother's jewels still sewn in place. I fingered it to feel for the jewels, then tucked it back in the trunk. How well Robert knew me. I lay back on the bed and closed my eyes. Was Pan really only a short distance away? Impatient to retrieve him, I reminded myself that I had one chance, and I must plan his rescue carefully. And where was Robert, I wondered. Was he on his way to Williamsburg with the baby? And what kind of reception would they receive there? The thought that I was a father still surprised me, but it also made me feel uneasy. From the beginning, I had questioned my ability to care for a child, but since I'd met the Spencers, any confidence I might have mustered was waning. After observing Mr. Spencer with his two daughters, I saw more readily what awaited me as a parent. The responsibility of raising a daughter on my own was beginning to feel overwhelming. I knew nothing of children, and the more immediate problem was that I had no home for her. How could I care for her when I was homeless myself? And yet she was all I had left. My throat tightened at the thought of Caroline, and a dark wave of grief threatened, just as whispers and then a knock sounded on my door. I leaped up to slip on my jacket before I invited my visitors to enter. When the door opened, the three girls presented themselves as one.
"Father is in his study, but he said we might invite you to take a walk with us, or would you prefer a rest?"
Addie asked. "Please come in," I said.
"Father said that we are only to stand at the door. It is not proper for young women to enter a man's bedchamber,"
Patricia announced importantly. Adelaide stepped in, pulling her sister along.
"I'm sure he meant that we had to be invited," she said, her eyes eagerly darting about.
Clara waited outside the room, but when I waved her in, she did not hesitate to join the other two. Addie tried to restrain herself as the two others gaped openly at the small oak table and my case of art supplies on the table. Then curiosity won out, and Adelaide, drawn to my open traveling case, moved in to take a closer look.
"Oh, what is in that one?" she asked.
I withdrew the cut glass bottle and unscrewed the silver top to let her sniff my bay rum cologne. She closed her eyes.
"Heavenly, Mr. Burton."
I offered the experience to Clara, who put her face too close. She sputtered and coughed, then looked at me as though I had tricked her. "Here," I said, showing her how to better take in the scent by wafting the bottle under her nose.
"You are a patient man," Adelaide said. "I wish I shared that virtue."
I chuckled at her outspokenness. When she smiled back, I reminded myself to use caution. The girl was immature and had lived an insulated life, and because of it, I supposed that she might misinterpret much. I threw on my old straw hat and slung a pair of field glasses around my neck. "But now you must take me for a walk," I said. "Do you think we might spy a Carolina parakeet? Are we far from Southwood? I hear there are many in that area."
"Oh, we don't have to go as far as Southwood. I've seen them everywhere," Adelaide said. "When did you see them? What did they look like, Addie?"
Patty asked innocently. Adelaide blushed as she scowled at her sister and then looked at me.
"I believe they are colorful, are they not?"
I took pity on her.
"You are so right," I said. "They are exceptionally colorful. Their forehead and upper cheeks are orange, while their neck and head are yellow. The rest of their plumage is green, and their legs and feet are a pinkish brown. Imagine that."
"Exactly so," agreed Adelaide. "Those are the ones I have seen."
"But have you seen the purple ones?" I teased, and when the three looked at me in disbelief, I winked at Patricia. For the first time, Clara spoke up.
"We don't see no purple birds round here," she said emphatically. "I might have seen one or two," Adelaide said.
"No, you don't," Clara answered.
Addie shot her a dark look.
"You shouldn't sass, Clara."
Patricia reached for Clara's hand.
"She's not sassing, are you, Clara?"
Clara shook her head.
"Might Addie have seen a purple bird, Mr. Burton?" Patricia asked.
"I believe that Miss Adelaide will see things that others might not," I replied, and was rewarded with another smile from Adelaide. "And now for our walk," I said, holding open the door to let the three of them dance out before me. "Could you show me the direction of Southwood from here?"
I doubted we would sight the bird, for the colorful parrot, the only species of its kind known to have existed this far north, had become scarce. The girls cared little if they saw the parrot, but squabbled over the use of my field glasses until I took them back for myself. I asked again about the Southwood plantation border, and they pointed to the property that appeared less than a mile or so away. Was it possible that Pan was really this close? Again, I had the thought of going directly over to claim him, but reminded myself that this was not Philadelphia, and here he was considered someone else's property. No, I must approach this carefully. Later in the day, I was back in my room debating my next move when Clara's mother, Hester, came to ask for my soiled clothing. She seemed pleasant enough, and because of her connection to the neighboring plantation, I hoped she might have some useful information. "I must say that your young charges are a credit to this household," I began, gathering the clothes that needed laundering. "Mrs. Spencer raised them right. Mr. Spencer gonna be lost without her. They all good girls," she said. "But that Miss Addie, she's something." I smiled at her honest observation and decided to risk raising the subject of Southwood. "I believe you came from Southwood?" I asked, and recognized my mistake when she scooped away my garments. "I don't talk about that," she mumbled, and made a quick exit. News of a traveling artist from Philadelphia must have been intriguing to the local gentry, for within days of my arrival, servants from the surrounding plantations began to arrive by horse or buggy to deliver social invitations. Fortunately, I managed to avoid attending these affairs by using as excuse my respect for Mr. Spencer's recent loss of his wife. However, with each new invitation, I became more anxious to retrieve Pan so we could leave. Though I doubted the museum would have made public the news of the withdrawal of their funding, or that Mr. Carden would have told anyone of the intimate and sensitive details of his family crisis, I did fear the gossip of servants, which often traveled faster than fire into the wealthy homes of Philadelphia. My chief concern was avoiding this select Carolina group of merchants and planters, with their strong business and personal ties not only to one another but to Philadelphia as well. There was a second concern, and it grew daily. With these southern plantations so interconnected, I was afraid that news of my whereabouts might alert people such as Jake or Rankin. If only my eye weren't such a distinctive feature. I had not heard from Robert, and I tried my best to set that concern aside, but my tension mounted. As etiquette dictated, I was obliged to wait for my host to arrange a meeting with his neighbor, but Mr. Spencer appeared to be in no hurry to do so. Keeping to my end of the bargain, I began art classes with the girls. Finding them receptive, I included some penmanship as well. Meanwhile, Mr. Spencer, clearly suffering the loss of his wife, sat for hours alone in his study or rode off by himself for long stretches of the day. When he was home, I saw how easily his daughters found their way around him and noted, too, how at a loss he appeared with them. Finally, one evening at the beginning of June, the two of us were alone in his study, and I could hold off no longer. "I understand that you purchased Hester from Southwood," I began. He folded down his newspaper as he guardedly eyed me. "I did," he said. "And as a northerner, you object?" "Actually," I said, "I do not have a strong opinion on that subject." "I see," he said. "I presumed otherwise." "In fact," I said, closing my own book, "in recent days I have come to believe that it might be wise for me to purchase a young Negro, one perhaps more familiar with this heat than I. He could travel with me and give me assistance when I am out in the woods. I was hoping that Southwood might have some possible candidates." He stared at me with a strong look that I could not interpret. "But I will need an introduction," I said. When that was met with silence, I resorted to the manipulation I had seen Addie use. "Yet you are reluctant? Do you think me somehow unsuited to meet with this Bill Thomas? Are you concerned that I might act in such a way as to embarrass you?" "My dear man," he sputtered, "you are badly mistaken." I had hit my mark and might have felt some guilt had I not had such genuine need. "I cannot imagine another reason," I said. "Perhaps I ask for too much?" "No," he said, "you do not. But I see that I must be frank. The truth is, I do not like to visit the place. Thomas is an unfriendly man, and he and I have had words on more than one occasion.
I do not like the way he runs things. That is how I came to purchase Hester. She made her way over to us one day in such a state that Mrs. Spencer would not allow her to return. Of course, I paid a heavy purse for her, and then one as heavy for Clara, though she was but a small child. He mopped at his forehead. No, Mr. Burton, there is no love lost between Mr.